Sunday passes as it always does, with church and Wyatt's cafeteria and the slow TV hours of the afternoon. Then it is Monday, and his mom is driving him across the river into the trees. And as they crest the hill and coast into the parking lot, the school grows gigantic in the windshield. They pull to a stop at the entrance. Something like a bird shoots out of his heart. Then he steps out onto the patio and becomes a part of it all.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with Little Rock novelist and short story writer Kevin Brockmeyer as he recounts a character named Kevin Brockmeyer's present tense adventures throughout his seventh grade year growing up in Little Rock.
The black streaks of tennis shoe rubber on the floor of the gymnasium. The glass walls of the front office. The Reeboks and Levi's, Izod's and bomber jackets, jelly bracelets and Swatch watches.
So let's lace up our Reeboks, pull on our Izod polos, don jelly bracelets and Swatch watches, zip up our bomber jackets, take a deep breath, hold it, and return to middle school in 1985 in order to become a part of it all. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking with award-winning novelist Kevin Brockmeyer, who has written several national best-selling books of fiction, including The Brief History of the Dead, The View from the Seventh Layer, and The Illumination.
When I was younger, I dreamed to be older. One day I'd figure it out.
Brockmeyer's newest effort, A Few Seconds of Radiant Film Strip, a memoir of seventh grade, published by Pantheon in 2014, is both hilarious and heart-wrenching.
And from the far back of nowhere, a memory comes to him. A few seconds of radiant film strip, in which he is standing over a busy street, his eyes locked on a sunlit concrete ledge where an orange peel rocks back and forth like a baby's cradle. How old was he wonders. Where did it happen and when? Was he alone?
Novelist, short story writer, prodigious list maker, former seventh grader turned memoirist, Kevin Brockmeyer, welcome.
Thank you very much, Brad.
The memoir begins on the last weekend before seventh grade for Kenneth, Tad, Bateman, and Kevin Brockmeyer, who we find hanging from a cliff, bracing his sneakers against chunks of stone and the whip handles of baby trees 25 feet above the parking lot. Why did you begin by having Kevin hanging off a cliff?
Well, first of all, because Kevin spent some time hanging off a cliff. So I did remain faithful to my experiences as they actually happened. Guys, hey Tad, Bateman, I need some help.
Having some trouble?
How do you guys make it up there?
See that big rock? You want to go around to the other side?
I can't, I'm stuck.
You weigh like 75 pounds, man.
Here.
Tad lets down an arm, and gravity instantly ropes his skin with veins. It seemed to me to be one of those moments when I was relying on this little group of my most intimate friends to assist me out of a moment of danger. These were the most important relationships in my life at the time. They were the relationships with which I began that school year. And they were also relationships that were doomed, although I didn't realize it at the time. Better than I thought it could be. There was a particular pizza joint on Rodney Parham, Amazio's Pizza. It's now gone. It's been replaced by an automotive parts dealership. And my friends and I spent a lot of time sneaking into Amazio's and filling our soda cups from their soda fountains. One by one, they fill them from the soda spouts. Someone has to cap off the line, and today it is Bateman, which means that he is the one waiting for the foam to settle when the stocky little manager comes tugboating over from the ovens, trailing a pair of skinny waiters behind him. He smacks a hand on the ice bin.
Just what are you boys doing?
These are endlessly refillable.
Look, Kit, the free refills are for when you're ordering something off the menu. You can't just wander in off the street and start drinking whenever you feel like it.
It doesn't say that on the commercials.
It's strongly implied.
What do you want us to do? Dump it out?
No. Go. Go. Drink your Cokes, but don't try to stun in here again.
So it's goodbye to the sunshine, goodbye to the dew, goodbye to the flowers, and goodbye to you.
At the time, Mazzio's Pizza had a policy whereby if you ordered a large drink in one of their plastic Mazzio's cups, you could keep the cup. And any time you returned to Mazzio's, you would get free soda refills. And so our idea was that we could just walk in off the street with these cups and fill them from the fountain and go waltzing back out with our drinks. And that wasn't the policy as Mazzio's had conceived it. So, I mean, this was how we filled our time in the days before we began the school year.
And of these friends you write in their group, Bateman is the clown, Tad is the heartbreaker, Kenneth the cool guy. What is Kevin?
There's a sentence in which I try to describe who he is to these people and how he feels to himself. And in fact, I think the book is filled with sentences like this. But one of them from that early chapter is this. He has always been the kid who cries too easily and laughs too easily. The kid who begins giggling in church for no reason at all, who blinks hotly in shame and frustration whenever he misses a question in class, living in an other land of sparkling daydreams and imaginary catastrophes.
If you want to find Miss Vincent, then I'll give you just one clue. The letter of where she is at has the same letter as you.
Seventh grade Kevin likes to write mystery stories.
He does.
The case of the missing Tanya Pickett. The case of the missing Ethan Carpenter. You used some of the language that you actually had written.
I did, so.
And incorporated it.
Yes. Like, the challenge of this conversation is figuring out whether to talk about myself in the third person or in the first person.
Right, right,
you know,
right.
Should I say Kevin did this, does this?
Or, seventh grade
or
Kevin.
Yes. So let me speak in the first person momentarily.
Okay.
As early as age 7, first grade, I kept myself entertained by writing stories. That's what I did in class when I had finished my schoolwork and I had a little time. And most of the stories that I remember best were, in fact, mystery stories, in which I was the detective. One of my classmates would go missing, and I would be tasked with solving the crime, which I would do, and then everybody would applaud for me. Like, that was the structure of all of these stories. They were little wish fulfillment fantasies.
I feel the time. The time has come. It's underneath my thumb.
The last of these that I remember writing was in seventh grade. And it was about an English teacher whom in the book is named Miss Vincent. Again, a pseudonym. And the story was called The Case of the Missing Miss Vincent. He plunges into the mystery with, the authorities were baffled, then sketches the facts of the case. How 2 days before, in fifth period, Miss Vincent had discovered Clint Fulkerson snoring at his desk, and when she couldn't wake him, left to fetch the principal. It was a scream, and no doubt about it, it was Miss Vincent. The scream brought the whole school running. Clint had even awoken. When we got to the stairs, though, all we found were some ink stains. Miss Vincent had been teacher-napped. And I gave it to this teacher, and she liked it very much and convinced me that I should put it on as a production in front of the student body.
What if I could rule the world?
In the morning, the entire student body has half an hour of chapel together. And it was during one of these half hours that I put on the show that I had kind of written, produced, and directed.
Yeah, if I could rule the world.
Aha, ink, like the ink in the stairwell, he thinks. He deduces that Clint Fulkerson must have been drugged with sleeping powder. But when he investigates the filing cabinet in the office for evidence, he uncovers only some confiscated candy, gum to be precise, and a paddle with a peculiar stain on it. The case seems hopeless.
When the day is done, when the day has passed, a new light shines, a new light will cast.
The next morning in chapel, he claims the microphone from Coach McAteer and explains everything. How Clint was disabled with tranquilizers to drive Miss Vincent from the classroom. How the pens were sabotaged and the stairwell doctored with ink as a ruse. But how the criminal forgot one crucial piece of evidence, the paddle, with its brown splashes of Diet Coke. And whose trademark drink is Diet Coke? Miss Vincent's. And who uses a paddle? The principal, Mr. McCallum. His villainy is inarguable, and he knows it. So once the detective, Kevin Brockmeyer, discovers this foul deed, he confronts the principal, who pulls a gun on him, and Kevin karate chops it out of his hands to save the day.
The world would be free.
Now, this is absurd, but within the context of the play, I had cast one of my classmates in the role of Kevin Brockmeyer, and his name in the book is Sean Hammonds. The day of the production, Sean got laryngitis, or claimed to have gotten laryngitis, which meant that I ended up playing myself on stage. Which is to say that I had not only written this wish fulfillment fantasy about besting the principal in physical combat, but I enacted this wish fulfillment fantasy in front of the entire student body, playing myself on the stage.
I feel the time is come.
I'm J. Bradley Menick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to seventh grade as we talk to writer Kevin Brockmeyer about his book, A Few Seconds of Radiant Film Strip, a memoir of seventh grade. Kevin has a tendency to believe the best in people until the very last second.
Within the context of this school year, those last five words are significant. It's not simply that I have the tendency to believe the best in people. It's that I have the tendency to believe the best in people until the very last seconds. And there's a very last second coming for seventh grade Kevin and this group of friends. In some ways, the structure of this book, the kind of narrative and emotional structure of this book, is about a boy who begins the school year with one set of friends, loses them, and ends the school year with a different set of friends.
Hey, Kevin, is it snack time yet?
By now, it must be snack time.
Yeah, isn't it snack time, Kevin?
I don't know about you guys, but I think I'm ready for a snack.
For snack time, let's share some M&Ms.
M&Ms makes friends.
All right, so let's just talk about this moment a bit with the riffing. Certainly, the boys in the book have not been as pleasant as they might to Kevin along the way, but in this particular moment, it's somewhat upsetting. They're relentless.
They are relentless. And this was when everything came to a head. And this was a day in which suddenly and inexplicably to me at the time, I lost the two or three friends who had seemed to me to be the center of my world. I didn't see it coming. In retrospect, I can see that it was coming. But I couldn't at the time. So they followed me around. Before and after school and during lunch, kind of taunting me. And they did it with a playful affect, like they pretended they were just playing around with me.
Let's get some M&Ms at the gas station. The gas station is where I get my M&Ms. Where do you get your M&Ms, Kenneth?
Same as everyone, duh, the gas station.
Me too, the Superstop.
It's super. The Superstop is super.
Superb.
Superb. The perfect place for chips and candy. Today for snack time. I don't know about you guys, but I recommend we walk to the gas station.
Hey, Kevin, have you ever made a Superstop?
But it was obvious to both them and me that this wasn't what was happening. They were casting me aside. And, you know, this went on for several weeks, and it spelled the end of any kind of real intimacy between me and these several boys who had been my best friends.
Will you be our pal, our super pal, Kevin?
Can we spend the night with you and eat Steak-Ums for dinner?
Super Steak-Ums?
Steak-Ums at dinner time and before bedtime at our pre-bedtime snack time? Can we eat some Crystal Light powder with a spoon, Kevin?
I can't go through life this way. Something's gonna give, I know. I've never felt this way. It's time to leave, it's time to grow.
I think the kind of displays I was prone to became an embarrassment to them. They were adolescents, and I wasn't. I was still a kid, but I wasn't.
And you were a wordsmith.
And I was a wordsmith, but I wasn't physically or emotionally mature.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't emotionally mature either, but they were physically mature.
We love Steak-Ums and Crystal Light powder.
And M&Ms.
Yeah, M&Ms.
What do you say, Kevin?
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 Hey, Kevin.
Super Kevin?
And this was the most difficult experience of my childhood. And in some ways, probably its effects continue to be felt in my life. But I hope that it doesn't seem that the book forbids its sympathies to these other boys, because it was important to me that they seem as fully invested in their own lives and as rounded in their characters as I was.
What lessons might Kevin provide for seventh grade kids?
Maybe I can simply say this, that the book itself doesn't offer a moral, but my stance when I was writing was to look at the self I used to possess and to say, every piece of that is important. It all matters. It will continue to matter. And if there is a lesson to be derived from that stance, it's that you can't abandon the self you used to possess.
I work too hard to win this now. I've been giving till our hope is gone.
So it must be the case that people want to talk about the middle section of the book.
Yes. In the middle of this whole thing is a single chapter that's divorced from the realism of the rest of the book. It happens after this bullying that I had experienced. Finally, I broke down. I was hiding away during lunch in the classroom of this same English teacher, Miss Vincent. And she asked me if I was okay, and I just began weeping. She escorted me into the hallway, asked me to wait there for a moment while she summoned the principal. And within the book, there's a chapter that's divorced from what came before and what's going to come out. So this is what happens to Kevin. He meets a character who is me, middle-aged Kevin.
And as we tumble through the years gone by, it's still
Kevin scrutinizes the man, his lean neck, his dark beard, the pigment spots on his forehead. His mannerisms are oddly familiar, like those of some halfway relative in the background of 100 family photos. The premise is that each of us, at some moment, is divorced from our life and given the opportunity to say yes to it or to say no to it. In other words, you get to decide whether you want ever to have existed at all or not. If you choose to have existed, then you return to your life and you forget that this experience ever took place. If you choose not to have existed, then your life is simply erased from the framework of reality, and reality reorients itself.
And after we've been here 10 hundred years and can't agree what it's all for.
So the book's conceit is that this is happening all the time. And it happens to each of us exactly once, and we're given the opportunity to make that decision, and we're told something about where our lives are going to take us.
Wise is the man who can let it go. Let it flow and roll and roll downstream. Yeah.
This is from later in the same chapter, when the mysterious figure Kevin has met is telling him something about his future.
Yeah.
And the only way you can keep believing you're secretly irresistible and yet doomed to live without love is by never putting yourself to the test. It's a mess, a wilderness of contradictions. Every year it will leave you feeling uglier and uglier, more and more tired. You'll have to become much more limber if you intend to maneuver your way out of it. And it's a very near thing for him. He ends up saying yes to his life and is returned to the pages of this book. And that middle chapter vanishes as if it had never taken place. But it lingers in the minds of the readers. It doesn't linger in the mind of Kevin. It doesn't linger in the mind of this character. But my hope was that this element of fantasy in the middle of the book would cast a light over everything that had come before and everything that had come after, and would make it sharper in the vision than it would otherwise have been. Because in the midst of all these difficulties, there's a boy saying yes to all of it.
Could you tell the story about the real Miss Vincent? You tracked her down.
Don't you forget where you've been, when no one recalls where you came from.
She was a very young teacher at the time. It was her first year of teaching. And she simply seemed like an adult to me. I was 13, she was 22.
Don't you lose sight of your dream when no one pays any attention.
But she only taught at CAC this one year. I think she's one of the heroes of the book. She was one of the heroes of my life, although I didn't know it at the time. But I realized it when I was writing the book.
It's all right to fall sometimes. You'll be strong when you arrive.
So, with a little diligent Google searching, I found a woman with a hyphenated name teaching English in Washington State. I sent her a letter saying, I don't know if you remember me, but I'm looking for the Miss Vincent that taught at CAC in 1985 and 1986. If this is the right person, here's who I am. Here's what I've done with my life. I included a copy of my novel, The Illumination. And I just wanted to say that the year in which I knew you was extraordinarily difficult for me. You made it easier than it otherwise would have been because you were kind to me.
Don't get caught up in the hatred. There's always a different point of view. You can be inspired and impassioned when helping those less fortunate than you.
And I was only a kid, and I wasn't capable of saying thank you and that I appreciate it at the time. But I'm capable of saying that now, and it's what I'd like to do. So it did, in fact, turn out to be the right woman I had found, and she wrote me back. She said she remembered me, and she was grateful to have heard from me. Said that it was meaningful to her, that she had been questioning how valuable her life in teaching had been, and that this was a reminder that her presence in the lives of these children, not only what she taught them in the classroom, but what she taught them by her humanity, was of value, and was certainly of value to this one kid.
It's okay to feel bemused. Just take your place and shine on through. Shine on through.
You write, there is a sound to finishing a story like the first note of the 3:30 bell. What was the sound of finishing this memoir, this story?
Well, I don't think this is the kind of book that's spoiled by knowing the final gesture. So maybe I can just read the last paragraph to you.
Perfect.
Kevin is sitting in chapel on the final day of the year, and the sixth graders have been bussed over from the elementary school to participate in this last chapel of the year. And Kevin is remembering what it was like to be one of those sixth graders anticipating seventh grade. And this is what he says. Kevin listened to their voices reflecting off the rafters, a great unanimous chorus of pre-altos and pre-tenors. Even the coolest of them had not yet learned that it was better not to demand too much attention. A year ago, he was one of them and had no idea where his life was going. As the next song began, he sat in the bleachers remembering what it was like, thinking, before you know it, nothing will be the same, saying, you're not me yet, but I'm still you.
When I was younger, I dreamed to be older. One day I'd figure it out. I would be wiser and life would be brighter. No worries to worry about.
Broadcast from the University District, this has been a special program on KUAR 89.1. Thanks for joining us. Arts and Letters and other programming that airs on this station can be found at KUAR.org. Thank you to Nikolai Gordeev, Eli Wooten, Gareth Bax, Linda Smith, and Steve Perry, our actors who supplied the voices. Thank you to singers and songwriters Brian Nolan,
better than I thought it could be,
Jesse Wells,
and after we've been here 10 hundred years,
and Max Gomez.
I feel the time has come,
whose original music radiates with brilliance and light. Thank you to the amazing Mr. Chris Hickey, whose radiant production illuminates these episodes. Generous support for this program was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to novelist and Little Rock author Kevin Brockmeyer, whose books allow us to dream about our future selves and take stock of what we've become. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, leaving you with the words of Italo Calvino. Sometimes one who thinks himself incomplete is merely young.
I feel the time has come.